Tonight's Shockwaves is brought to you by the following advertisers. Tonight's episode is brought to you by Full Moon Entertainment. Get ready to delve deep into the weird world of essential cult entertainment only on Full Moon's Amazon channel. Classic Full Moon and Empire picture faves like Castle Freak, Puppet Master, Subspecies, Necropolis, Intruder, Head of the Family, Evil Bong, The Ginger Dead Man, Laser Blast, The Pit and the Pendulum, and Lurking Fear share space with a wild library of cult creepers from the legendary Blue Underground and Something Weird video labels, the Andy Sedaris and Jess Franco collections, the Euroscene archives, Trailers from Hell, and much, much more. It's an unlimited onslaught of awesome right at your fingertips 24/7. New uncut movies are added every week, and all titles are available in the highest definition available. So get yourself over to Amazon and subscribe to Full Moon today for only $6.99 a month. Your glaze balls will never be the same again. Trust us.
Available now from exploitation film gurus at Vinegar Syndrome, Juan Antonio Bardem's atmospheric Spanish giallo, The Corruption of Chris Miller, plus two from legendary producer Nico Mastorakis, Familial Terror at Grandmother's House, and Trashy Slasher Antics in Darkroom, plus Gerard Damiano's introspective sex drama, Skinflix. Coming soon in May, the North American Blu-ray premiere of Mountaintop Motel Massacre, plus two surprise limited edition releases, including an early 80s regional horror gem, all of which and much, much more will be unveiled during their infamous Halfway to Black Friday sale occurring Memorial Day weekend at VinegarSyndrome.com. Also, don't forget to visit them at Texas Frightmare Weekend in Dallas, Crypticon in Seattle, and Pop-Up in at Videomatica in Vancouver. For more info on their upcoming Halfway to Black Friday sale, releases, and conventions, visit VinegarSyndrome.com.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Fangoria. In July of 1979, the first issue of Fangoria was released into the world. And now, this summer, Fangoria magazine is turning 40 and celebrating accordingly with its fourth issue. 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated content honoring horrors past, present, and future. These articles and interviews will never be published online, so the only way to read them is by getting your hands on a physical, collectible copy of your own. We can't give anything away because we want the experience to be a surprise, but we can safely say that you do not want to miss a single page in issue 4. Head to Fangoria.com to learn more and subscribe. If you subscribe today, your subscription starts with the 40th anniversary issue, number 4, shipping in July. Use the code SHOCKWAVES to save 10% off your subscription. Again, that code is SHOCKWAVES for 10% off, so go ahead on over to Fangoria.com.
Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. We're celebrating halfway to Halloween with a classic retro-style nylon jacket on pre-order from now through Sunday, May 5th. And Barbara Crampton will be debuting her very own signature shirt at Texas Frightmare, which will also be available exclusively on our site Monday, May 6th. Brand new shirts, pins, and socks coming next Wednesday for Return of the Living Dead. And our Shockwaves listeners can save 10% now at checkout by entering code WAVES10. Again, that's 10% off by using code WAVES10.
The Shockwaves crew is currently at Texas Frightmare, presented by Arrow Video. This is the Southwest premier horror convention, now in its 14th year. So if you are listening to this, please head on over to Texas Frightmare, happening right now. We are there with Bruce Campbell, Tim Curry, Robert Englund, Lee Majors, Meatloaf, Joe Bob Briggs, and many more. Film celebrations include Halloween, Reanimator, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Rocky Horror Picture Show, and Evil Dead. This is May 3rd through 5th, 2019, at the Hyatt Regency DFW Airport. Shockwaves is there right now. Please head on over to www.texasfrightweekend.com for more information, and we hope to see you there.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of Shockwaves. We are at the Chattanooga Film Festival. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo. I'm here with Elric Kane.
Yep, we survived our first night and our red eye to get here.
You did not vomit yet, thank God.
I have not vomited.
It's technically our second night.
It is, okay. I don't know.
Rebecca McKendry is here as well.
Hello.
Hello, and we're excited. We carved out a little time so we can spend this next hour with Mr. Joe Bob Briggs, our guest.
Well, I didn't realize that. I thought I was done with shockwaves. I thought you only had to do that once in your life.
You are never done with shockwaves.
Here I am, second year in a row.
You did the live one. These are the follow-up questions.
I didn't know you made people do this twice.
Oh, yeah.
When they're good and requested, you go.
Well, and especially when they recommend a certain film from Brussels.
All right,
for us to go watch.
Okay, which so, people gave us copies of.
I can't believe, of all the things we talked about last year, you go and watch the pig fucking movie.
And people sent us copies of the pig fucking movie.
Yes, we're getting context.
You mentioned the pig fucking movie, and then a few days after the episode aired, a company from Europe, a Blu-ray company called Camera Obscura, reached out to me. They're like, we put out the pig fucking movie. Do you want a copy? And I'm like, sure.
So they sent us each a copy.
They sent us that and a handful of other really great, mostly giallo titles.
But some of them were amazing. Like Rome Arm to the Teeth was like one of my favorite films.
Yeah, there's good stuff in there. But Elric and I, in honor, knowing that we would see you today.
About a week ago, we did this.
It's a European Blu-ray disgusting movie company.
Yes,
is that what you said?
They have some classy giallos in there, but yeah.
But we watched this pig fucking movie.
Well, we watched 45 minutes.
That's as much as we could make it. We were really shocked.
We did see the pig fucking.
Okay,
what I didn't get to see is the love afterwards. I think I had a little baby.
You missed the cuddling.
And there was some Lynchian like sound design.
You didn't see the post-coital pig?
Not too much of that. But they did. Well, no, we did. We saw the birth, and after that, I was like, I don't know if we need to finish.
We gave up where we were looking at something on the screen, and Elric's like, what is that? And I'm like, I think it's a pig vagina.
Oh, yeah.
And then 2 seconds later, a little baby pig came out of it. And I'm like,
oh, yep, God.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we're like, wait, is the guy the father of this pig thing? And we gave up. We were like, look, we did it the best we could.
I think what we're trying to say is thank you. To sum up,
I think the original question was there ever a movie too intense for you to watch or something like that?
Yeah.
And I said there was that
recommendation.
it was kind of a recommendation, yeah. but it was on a recommendation on the extreme end of the spectrum. Yeah. So
wow,
well, we did it out of honor.
Yeah.
And then last night, you changed up to the How Rednecks Saved Hollywood, which was
remarkable.
One of the best times I've had in a long time, and I you could tell the crowd just had such a good time.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we wanted to go and see Smokey and the Bandit immediately
as soon as
after.
It ended.
Yeah. I wish they were showing that here.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a great show, and hopefully we'll get to the second part of your we were going to say last year you started a great lecture on what was
history
it exactly?
The history of exploitation.
Yes.
And the history of exploitation is so complex that I only got, I think I got to the 50s.
You're about to go into the 60s.
I think maybe I was in the 40s or the 50s. And so, that was all I could get into 2 hours. And so I promised to do it again this year. And then I got booked to so many shows that I couldn't do all the research, to finish up the show. And so I just did this show last night as a benefit for the Chattanooga Film Festival because they had invited me here 4 years ago when I first developed that show. And since then, I've done it everywhere. I thought it was just a Southern show. I used to just do it only in cities that have Confederate monuments.
Yeah.
But
those are gone too now, so.
No, they're not.
But in the last year, I've started doing it in the North, in bastions of Yankee sentiment like Boston and Minneapolis, and they did not kill me or threaten my life, and so I think people ask me who is my audience, and I think my audience is people in red states that don't wear MAGA hats.
Okay. That totally, I get that exactly.
Well, I love what you said last night, though, about how you used to get told by censors that you're too outrageous for the old people.
Yeah.
And that you're going to offend them. And now you're being told, you know, you're going to shock and offend the young people. And I think that's a great thing.
By the way, which is true, because even on your live episode, people like all the way through the history of our show are like, oh man, I hope one day you guys get Joe Bob on. And then we finally get you on. And most people are excited. And then there were younger listeners that were offended by something you said.
It was, right. It was a word. And it was like, is that race? It was like a questionable word. And that was it. And I can't even remember what it was now. But yeah.
Well, I sort of have the list of words that I can no longer say. That all the words that I used to say that I would say as a joke, it was a joke on the word. In other words, I realized that the word is a bad word. I'm saying it anyway as a joke, which people often do in stand-up.
And you
accept it in stand-up if you're in a club. But if you do it over the air, people get upset, you know. And so, so I don't say those words anymore, but simply because I don't want people to be upset. But people are a little too sensitive, you know.
Well, especially looking back at old movies, I find a lot of people are trying to judge them through a modern lens rather than just accept them for something of the time period.
Yeah, context.
And that makes it very tricky because movies can't change. You know, they're stuck.
I mean, should we never again watch Birth of a Nation? You know, it's racist. It's pure racism. But, but it also has all of those D.W. Griffith techniques that are sort of the basis of future films. You know, so do we stop watching that stuff?
And can you learn from the stuff. Mm-hmm. Just because it's racist doesn't mean they're saying not to be learned from it.
If we apply the Harvey Weinstein standard to old movies, then we can't watch anything made by Warner Brothers ever, because Jack Warner was a thousand times worse than Harvey Weinstein. He was horrible. Huh. He was horrible. He was the worst guy in the history of the casting couch. Okay. Wow. So every movie made by Warner Brothers from the 20s up through whenever he died in the 50s or the 60s, you know, we should not watch those movies. Yeah. But we can't do that. We can't start looking at, the moral probity of the guys who make movies. Really? You really want to go down that road?
Nothing left.
Well, we were joking, God forbid, because we were talking about the Motley Crue movie, The Dirt. God forbid they apply this rule to musicians.
Oh, like, my God.
There would be nothing left to listen to.
And I saw that critique of the Motley Crue movie where it was like, oh, my God, this is just so misogynistic. The women are just pieces of meat. But I think that's actually how they kind of viewed them. So it feels legit. But even within that, I loved how your lecture that you did last night, which was on how rednecks took Hollywood, or specifically how the redneck icon kind of became a staple within Hollywood. I loved that you were able to kind of traverse exploitation cinema, low budget, into big Hollywood films and then back again seamlessly. Like there was just no difference between the two of them.
The way the redneck is often used as a stereotypical villain is usually in the big Hollywood films. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like they go to Mississippi for 6 weeks to make the film, and they find a bunch of rednecks, and they feel good about themselves because they've preached to the choir about the racist South. And
Mississippi Burning type movies. Yeah, that right. you cited those. Yeah, unlike things like Poor Pretty Eddie, where you're just like, holy shit.
Oh well, that's Southerners making movies about Southerners and saying,
or outsiders coming in.
We really are this weird.
But there are some gems in there. We need to get a list because there's a handful I hadn't heard of, and they're the ones that you're like, oh, what's the one out of the Miss Virginia?
Shotgun Wedding.
No, not Shotgun Virginia.
Nashville Girl.
The Nashville Girl. Yeah. I hadn't heard of that one. And
you know what? Every time I do the show, I have a show of hands. Has anybody seen Nashville Girl? Mm-hmm. Now, there were four or five people last night who had seen it.
I was one of them.
Usually zero people have seen the movie. And I think it's because it was pulled from distribution. It is just too politically incorrect. I mean, it's like a 16-year-old girl making her way in the entertainment business by sleeping with everybody in the business is so wrong today that even though it was made by Roger Corman, and Roger Corman made a lot of money with it, and Roger usually the political subtext of a Roger Corman movie is very left. It's very to the left, you know, except when it involves female issues, you know, because he was also like the inventor of the formulas for female breast nudity, you know, and so, you know, so there's conflicting messages in, in some of these movies.
And yet it works. Do you remember your first Corman film, like that you would have seen in a drive-in?
Well, I wouldn't have known it was a Corman film, probably, but... You know, it probably would have been something like The Student Nurses or one of those.
Like one of the Jack Hill ones or something.
Yeah.
But even Student Nurses, it's heavily left. Like, it feels very almost feminine. That's the Stephanie Rothman one, right?
Anytime you're going to show, say, 50 naked women in a movie, you want it to have a feminist subtext. Otherwise, you're not going to get away with it.
Yeah.
So that's why all women in prison movies have, you know, like a victorious squad of women, you know, who break out of the prison, you know. Yeah. It's funny because I had a conversation with Martin Scorsese one time, and it's like, what are you talking about with Martin Scorsese? You know, it's like, you're going to look like an idiot, anything. And so he says, what do you think is the best women in prison movie? And I said, oh, okay, I can go down this road. And I said, well, I don't know. I think a lot of people would say Big Birdcage, but I would say Chained Heat. And he says, you know what? I think I agree with you. And he said, now, would you agree that the women in prison movie is its own genre? It's not a subgenre of the prison movie. And I said, am I going to disagree with Martin Scorsese? I said, absolutely, Mr. Scorsese. You know, it's its own genre. But I think he's correct. It's a genre that has absolutely nothing to do with a prison movie. Yeah. It's like a women in prison movie is all about the sexuality. Now, sometimes the male prison movies are also about sexuality because they drop the soap in the shower or whatever, and you see a lot of naked butts or whatever. But it's a minor plot point way back in the backstory of the movie. Whereas with women, it's all about who's going to sexually abuse the women, right? Yeah. And so the women in prison movie becomes politically correct from day one, from the day somebody invented the women in prison movie, you know, and so the fact that it lasted so long is because they put so many. They said, okay, look, if we're going to do this, we got to have this four woman squad of kung fu mamas that break out of the prison. Otherwise, nobody's going to buy this story, and no one's going to like this story, you know. And so that's kind of like the bait and switch they do on great exploitation films.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's your on-set conversation when you're shooting Casino with Martin Scorsese. It's all about women in prison. That's your downtime.
What does he want to talk about? He wants to talk about the women in prison movie.
I love that. That's great.
That's awesome.
He obviously researched you, so that's good.
My other great – you know, it's like he knows everything about, you know, Indonesian film, but he also knows everything about exploitation film. And, you know, the other thing that was interesting talking to him is I said, what do you think of Honeymoon Killers? Because – he got fired.
That's right.
He
I didn't know he got fired. I knew he left it before Leonard Castle.
No, he directed the first. He directed a week on Honeymoon Killers, and then they fired him. And he said, I've never watched it. Yeah. And I said, really? And he says, it's too painful. I couldn't. Mm. I got fired. And I said, well, you know, I'm sure the guys, you know, who made it are probably sorry they fired you. And he said, oh no, they should have fired me. And I said, why? And he says, because I was shooting films. That was my first film. And I was shooting them the same way I shoot them today, with long tracking shots with no coverage. Mm. I was shooting these long, continuous shots. I had no coverage. They're looking at this first time director and they're saying, what do we do if he fucked that up? You know, there's no way to cover it later in post. Yeah. And so they should have fired me. You know? Wow. And I said, he says, but when I made my second movie, he says, I didn't work for 3 years and I thought I was never going to work again. And he said, but when I finally got to my second movie, which was the Roger Corman movie,
Boxcar Bertha.
He says, we're in Arkansas. He says, I'm storyboarding every scene for the time when the producers show up, so that I have these storyboards. And sure enough, Roger comes one day and he says, how are you doing? And we show him all the storyboards and he glances at them, for about 30 seconds. And then he says, oh, you're doing fine. And he leaves. And I thought, oh my God, okay, I'm not getting fired from this movie,
I loved your, you did a thing on Cue the Winged Serpent on Shudder last week and tribute to Larry, obviously, Larko. And I did read that Tony LoBianca being cast in Honeymoon Killers by Scorsese is directly why he ended up in God Told Me To, another one, another great Larry Cohen film. So there is a segue there. But what did Larry Cohen's movies mean to you? Because I love some of the stuff you're talking about, how you can always tell his films, because he's very different than Corman, and he's different from so many of these people because he plays with all these different genres, somehow matches it together with a message.
First of all, there are very few people in history, in film history, who are natural storytellers, who can just sit down and write a story, and it has three acts, and it has hooks, and it has suspense, and it has everything. And from the time he was a teenager, Larry Cohen was writing these amazing stories. He was writing them for live TV, and then he was writing them for scripted TV, and then he was writing movies. And so he always has this this incredible story value that very few directors have. But in addition to that, and what I love about Larry Cohen is he loves character actors. He takes character actors and he gives them leads in movies. And so, he especially likes, underdog, what would I call it? Underdog guys trying to be tough.
Michael Moriarty, right?
Like Michael Moriarty. Yeah.
You never think he's working for the mafia.
The most unlikely protagonist ever.
He likes to take, the ordinary guy who can't quite make it in the criminal underworld and do a story about, his struggling attempts to be a master criminal, And he loves the seedy underworld, and he loves the gritty streets of New York. He's from New York, so he loves all the great elements of film noir and horror, and many of his films are mixed genre. You can't really describe him as anything except a Larry Cohen film. In Cue the Winged Serpent, he has a monster. And this shows you his confidence as a director, though. He makes the whole movie without the monster. Yeah. And then he takes all his footage back to L.A. and he tells two guys, in special effects, you're going to create the monster for me. And they say, okay, well, we're going to tell you where you need to leave space in the movie for the monster. And he says, oh, no, you don't understand. I already shot the movie. You're going to make the monster to fit what I've already shot, And we'll just have him flying across. I did a lot of helicopter shots of Manhattan. So we're going to be able to, show the monster flying across the skyscrapers of Manhattan and all this. And sure enough, I mean, they make that work. A lot of it is because he just does the POV of the monster himself. Yeah. Yeah. So he shows people being eaten.
Yeah.
There's some
pretty creative that I will be watching when you showed it on Shudder. There's a great silhouette scene where you just see the beautiful silhouette against the building. How did he do that?
And it's scarier than seeing that rubber monster.
Yeah, much better. Yeah, it's great. But truly, he's definitely a one of a kind. The only other movie I really wanted to just hear, I've never really heard you mentioned it last night, it's Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I was just curious because we've talked to some great people about their first time seeing a movie like Psycho or Texas Chainsaw in theaters, because it's obviously very different than watching it 20 years later. But what was your, being a Texas guy, what was your relationship to that movie?
I saw it at a midnight show in the 70s, and the thing that impressed me about it is, if you remember the very beginning of the movie, it's just a series of quick images. Mm-hmm. They're less than a second images of, and you don't know exactly what you're watching, but what you are watching is images from a slaughterhouse and this weird music behind the images from the slaughterhouse. And then that there's a type crawl that's really badly written, but it implies that everything you're about to see is a true crime that occurred at a certain time, and then they go to a cemetery. By the time they got to the cemetery, there were already people walking out saying, mm-hmm. I can't take this. Yeah. Okay, so the power of the movie, now, you know, later generations that can freeze frame the movie and analyze it and everything, they don't get the full emotional impact of, if you're watching it, you're not sure who made it. You think it may have been made by a maniac.
Yeah.
You know? And it was just like that title, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know what you're going to see. They're telling you what you're going to see. People were just like, I don't think I can watch this. I don't think I can do it, even though I've paid my admission and I'm here. And the other scene, the main Walker scene, was the Pam on a meat hook. When he puts her on the meat hook, people would walk out and never come back. So I remember being so impressed that a movie could have that level of emotional power and be that scary, and that started my fascination with the film.
Was there anything that was too much for you, or were you fine with it?
Almost everything was too much for me. Except when they get to the part at the end where they're trying to put the hammer in the hands of Grandpa, so that he can finish off Marilyn Burns. I was like, oh man, they're going in this comedy direction right at the moment of maximum terror. And so that was interesting to me too. It was like, oh my God, you know, it's like at the ultimate extreme of terror, there's comedy. You know, it's like, well, you know, who made this? You know, this
was that not a Texas thing? Did you choose to do that?
It was very much a Texas thing. I mean, everybody in it was from Texas, and it was shot in Texas. But I really think if they'd gone with one of the original titles, like Leatherface, you know, I don't think it would have been as notorious as it was. It was actually the head of the Texas Film Commission who came up with the title,
oh, really?
The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
They wanted you to own that stuff.
He was hanging around and he said, you know what, you should call this The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And they said, you know, you're right. I think that's a better title.
Got a great ring to it. Do you remember the first time you met Tobe Hooper? Like with The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, just for context, like, was it an immediate like hit, or did it kind of did it take a while for the notoriety and people to start talking about it?
It was an immediate hit. It was distributed by the mafia. It was distributed by the same people that distributed Deep Throat, Bryanston Pictures. It was a mafia front company. It was based in L.A. and they knew how to promote. One thing they knew was how to promote. And one of the first things they did is they donated a print of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre to the Museum of Modern Art, because the Museum of Modern Art tries to collect all the films of the entire world, and so they will accept any film. Okay, so they donated the film to the Museum of Modern Art and then put in all their advertising, part of the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. And then they sneaked the film in San Francisco at a screening where they knew a bunch of San Francisco politicians would be there. So that because they were going to the taking of Pelham 1-2-3, and it was sneaked right after it. And so they knew that the politicians would be scandalized by the film, even if they didn't watch it. They would see the title, they would see the opening, they wouldn't watch it, they'd be scandalized. And sure enough, it worked. There were calls to ban the film right away, and it took off from there, and it just became this notorious film. I mean, Johnny Carson put it in his monologue one night. You know, it was this huge thing of the most disgusting film ever made, and it grew from there. Then the New York intellectuals attacked it as the pornography of violence. I mean, there were so many articles, and the articles all got wrong what was actually in the film. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was almost as though they didn't watch the film, but they wrote these pieces about how horrible it was, and how in Texas, you know, you can kill anybody and get away with it, and you know, they were appalled. Mostly by the fact that it takes place in Texas, so there was all this built-in publicity for it that lasted for years. Nobody knows exactly how much money it made because it was mafia bookkeeping. Mm-hmm. So they were trying to collect the money for years, and finally, a judge in the 80s gave it back to the original investors, who were a bunch of Austin politicians, and the sequels were owned by them, but it played in virtually every country of the world except the Muslim countries. Mm-hmm. Was known by a number of different titles, but it was probably one of the most successful indie films in history.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So. And I mean, obviously, I know you did a little bit in Chainsaw 2 years later, even though that got cut out. But when did you meet Toby? Were you already friends with him by the time the sequel happened?
The first time I met him was on the set of Chainsaw 2, because I was actually on the set of Chainsaw 2 to do an article for Rolling Stone. They sent me down there to interview Dennis Hopper. Mm-hmm. And Dennis Hopper was coming out of rehab. And he had been invisible for several years. And the first movie he made out of rehab was, and by the way, the rehab was successful. I don't think he ever did drugs the rest of his
life. He became
super
conservative after. Yeah. That's the thing about him, those traits.
He came out of rehab and he told his agent, I want to make this movie in Texas. And the agent said, don't do that. That should not be your first movie after rehab. And he says, I love Austin, and it's in the summer, and I like to go to the Willie Nelson picnic and play golf with Willie. Wow. So I want to make this movie. And so, you know, so he's showing up in Austin. So I go down to Austin to do the article for Rolling Stone. And while I'm there, Kit Carson, the screenwriter, says, hey, Toby wants to meet you, you know. And so I go meet him and say, oh, you that guy that writes all the good things about Texas Chainsaw Man? Because I was, for a long time, I was the only critic that was sort of celebrating the movie instead of talking about the pornography of violence. And so Toby says, here, Kit. Write a scene for Joe Bob. Write a scene for Joe Bob. And so we go off in the corner and write a couple of scenes and we shoot the scenes. And then before the movie comes out, 2 weeks before the movie comes out, Toby Hooper calls me and he says, you know, I am so sorry. Canon is trying to cut running time on the movie. And they cut out those two scenes. Uh-huh. And I said, that surprises me so much, Toby, because they were such an integral part of the story arc. Yeah. Those scenes really make the movie. You know, I'm just really surprised they would want to cut out those particular scenes, you know. And so they put them back in on one of the Blu-rays. That's when I first met him. But later when I did... I did an article on the movie, on the sort of the history, the political history of the movie, and I went to I met him in Hollywood at some Tony upscale restaurant where he used to eat lunch, and then later I met him at his house in Austin. And did some pretty, he was a reclusive guy. So when I was finally able to sort of grab him and get him to talk, he was a reclusive guy and he smoked a lot of weed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when I was able to get him when he was not smoking weed and when he was in a talkative mood, I got most of my information on the whole history. But I tell you who was better is Kim Henkel, the screenwriter and collaborator with Toby. Kim Hinkle had sort of turned his back on Hollywood. He didn't want to work in L.A. and he'd gone back to Texas and written some indie films that were, you know, very regional, and was living in a beach house in Port Aransas. And so I went and talked to Kim, and Kim was a font of information, and remembered everything very well. And he had no hang-ups about the movie. He just said, you know, we were a bunch of kids making a movie. We were lucky to get the attention that we got. I don't know why everyone is so crazy about the movie, you know? And so he was much better source of information, because Toby would say, yeah, I sort of remember that. Yeah, I can't quite access it. He would say, can't quite access it, you know?
What was Toby's set demeanor since you got to work with him on set? I've always been curious, because he always was so soft-spoken and quiet and reserved.
Bad with actors. Doesn't give the actors anything to work with. Just expects the actors to come on and do what they're going to do. If he does give the actors direction, he gives them external direction, which actors hate, you know. And so he would say, act like Strother Martin, you know.
That's good direction. I love Strother Martin. You put him in anything.
So, you know, so it's such stuff like that, you know, that actors like, well, how do I work with this? You know, what do I do with this? You know. He was not an actor's guy. He was very much a cinephile. So he's very much a camera guy. He loved any device that allowed him to look through the lens in a different way. I mean, he loved the TV screens and all that stuff. And, you know, he was definitely, he was an editor type, you know. If at one end of the spectrum you have John Cassavetes, you know, he's an actor type.
Yeah.
You know, at the other end of the spectrum you have, what would be a good example, you know.
Maybe Kubrick or something.
Kubrick, you know, he's in the post-production suite all the time.
Yeah.
You know, Toby is way closer to Kubrick. He's way closer to, you know, a European experimental filmmaker, you know.
Did the quirkiness that he exhibits in his film, because like if you watch like Eaten Alive or The Mangler, like there's always this kind of quirkiness, this humor to them. Did that ever come out in his personality?
I mean, he was just extremely laid back. I mean, he used the word man more times than any any human being I've ever met.
I might challenge that with Dennis Hopper.
Yeah, well,
the other guy.
Dennis Hopper and Toby were right neck and neck.
Don't you think weed goes directly to man?
Yeah.
Weed first,
yeah.
Then the man.
So, you know, he was a hippie. I mean, Toby was a hippie. And he was like, just sort of like Willie Nelson. He was a hippie all his life, you know. So I actually think that maybe what held him back in Hollywood is like he couldn't have the high powered meeting. He couldn't have the, you know, the great elevator pitch, because he's going to sit there and say, well, I was thinking, you know, man, that thing that they do, man, wasn't going to be good in a pitch meeting in L.A. And so maybe that's what sort of like, you know, he was struggling to the end of his life to get his next indie deal, whereas other people of his age who had made horror movies like John Carpenter and Wes Craven and other people were, you know, they eventually had kind of a comfortable life. That never happened for Toby Hooper. He was always fighting for that next deal.
Yeah. All right. I want to segue to last. It's only been 1 year since we talked to you last. And when we were talking to you, for us, it was a big deal to meet you, but you had yet to have this huge comeback. I mean, you've since broken the internet, which hadn't really happened.
Last show was right before.
It was like a couple weeks, I feel.
First marathon.
Yeah.
Because you revealed on the last Shockwaves that Tourist Trap would be the first film.
Yeah.
Yep.
Shudder was probably angry.
So it's probably the appearance on our show that, you know, led to this huge success.
We'll take the credit.
But so much has changed. It's wild.
Well, July 13th, 2018 was when we did the first marathon on Shudder. It was 13 movies on Friday the 13th. And I honestly thought that we were doing a nostalgia play, you know, because they just wanted us to do Monster Vision just exactly as we did Monster Vision in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, we can do that one time and maybe people will be interested in that. Mm-hmm. You know, the people that know Monster Vision.
Did they give you any updates on it or did they just say, just do what you do?
They just said, do what you do. I mean, my director, Austin Jennings, is 32 years old. Okay. He watched Monster Vision as a kid. He remembers every episode. Mm. He remembers stuff that I don't remember. He remembers movies that we did that I don't remember. I mean, we did 110 movies a year. I did 110 movies a year for 16 years on, on the movie channel and on TNT. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of stuff that we did that, you know, and he'll say, did you remember when you did that stunt? And I'll say, no. And I say, what kind of set we're going to have? Well, we're going to have the iconic set. And I say, well, which one is the iconic set? so it's good to have Austin around because he has a framework for what is popular. And so when I was talking to Austin, I said, well, all right, what are we going to do in the show? We're going to do Monster Vision. Okay, what else are we going to do? We're going to do Monster Vision, just Monster Vision. You know, it's like, so all the elements that are in Monster Vision, but we'll update those, right? No, just do Monster Vision. We're just going to do Monster Vision exactly as you did Monster Vision. And I said, you know, I've already done that show twice, and it's been 20 years. It's like, you know, this will be the third time I'll do the exact same show. That's fine. Just do the exact same show.
You just keep going, man.
and so we did the exact same show, and I'm you know, ready for anything. And leading up to it, we announced it about 3 weeks before, and the very first person to blog about or tweet about it was Stephen King. Yeah. And he says, you know, it's going to be on this date and I can't wait, you know. So of course that went viral through my world, you know. Stephen King saying I'm going to watch it. And then James Rolfe, the angry video game nerd, who's a big YouTube influencer, he wanted to do extensive interview with me for all his millions of fans and everything. And so he just kind of jumped on the bandwagon. And so suddenly people are saying, hey, this thing's going to happen on July 13th. And so there was kind of a thing building. Now, we had shot, we were in the, we didn't have any money. And so we were in the, there's a show called Ink Master. That's a reality tattoo show. Mm. And they have a studio that's in an abandoned factory in the slums of Newark, New Jersey. And they had an extra room that we could use. And so we're in this room in...
you have to get a tattoo first.
part of the play, Jim.
And so we're in New Jersey. And one of the guests that I'm going to have on the show is Felissa Rose, mm-hmm. the star of Sleepaway Camp. And so... Felissa Rose makes her way to the abandoned factory in the slums of New Jersey, and she gets there and she says, Joe Bob, this is really special. And I said, Felissa, what the fuck are you talking about? What do you mean really special? She says, I'm feeling that this show is going to be really special. And I said, Felissa, we are in the slums of New Jersey. Borrowing a room from Ink Master. You know, what is special about this? And she says, I don't know. I just have a feeling it's special, you know.
So she's very spiritual.
Like, yeah, she's sweet.
And so I was like, okay, all right. You know, I'm going to go with your optimism, Felissa. And so the show starts and a lot of people have made plans to watch it all the way through 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And so they've scheduled parties, and so you know, starting about a half hour before, people suddenly go on social media and they'll say, "What the fuck? I can't get this. I can't get this. I can't get Shudder. I can't. You know, there's just a thing on my screen that's going crazy, and it won't lock into the live feed, and you know, and I'm." I paid for this. You know, I'm outraged. I'm never going back to this damn thing ever again. And, you know,
because I think the original pitch was it was live, and we didn't know that they were going to catalog it.
Yeah,
it was a live feed. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so 30 minutes after it's supposed to start at 9 Eastern time, I think it was, it's supposed to start. So then at 9:30, all the social media changes. And it's like, Joe Bob, oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. I'm getting all these, you know, texts, emails, tweets, you know. Do you know what happened? No, what happened? You broke Shudder. You broke the internet. And I'm like, okay, can anybody see the show? No. Nobody can see the show. I said, is this good? Yeah, it's great. You broke the internet. You broke Shudder. Well, I kind of wanted people to see the show. You know, no, this is better than that. You broke the internet. You know, and not only did we break Shudder, we broke the Sundance Channel. Well, I don't care about breaking the Sundance Channel. Fuck the Sundance Channel. You know, but you know, somehow we were connected to the Sundance Channel. And so about halfway through the second movie, people started coming back online, mm-hmm. and the technicians were like working through the night. And I'm getting these emails from Shudder saying, "We're working through the night. We're working through." And I'm like, "Well, you know, we're already on, you know." And so, and they're like, "Well, we're working through the night. You know, believe me, we're on this, you know." And so people would start coming back on. And these online communities formed. Well, these online communities of people trying to get the signal were the basis of today's online communities that watch every week together. They watch together. They had this bonding experience on the night of when nobody could get the show. And so they formed these groups, and they always watch the show on the live feed. And so it turned out to be a good thing, I guess. I mean, and because everyone was so pissed off, Shudder immediately put the stuff up on demand. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Originally, we were not going to do that. It was going to be, you know, a few weeks later, we were going to put it on demand. And so, but they immediately put it off because everybody was going to, it was just too angry. And so the fact that people were able to watch it. Now, what was interesting is some people watched it from the beginning all the way through, even though it was on demand. I said, boy, that's hardcore.
Yeah.
That's serious, you know. But at the time I was getting these messages, I remember this one guy, he says, Joe Bob, I'm in Hell's Kitchen. I'm in the basement of my building. The fire marshal says I can only have 30 people in here. I have 60. We have some big screen TVs and some kegs. What am I supposed to tell all these people? And so I wrote back to him, tell them to go for the kegs, and the big screens will be on later. But there were people having these viewing parties, you know, and they were like, oh, well, this sucks. You know? that was the marathon. And then so because of that, Shudder wanted to do additional marathons. And I was like, okay, so now what are we going to do? We kind of blew our wad on this, you know, and it's like, oh, same thing, you know, really? Yeah, just do Monster Vision again, you know, okay, we'll do it again. So we did a Thanksgiving marathon, we did a Christmas marathon, now we're doing a double feature every week. So
was that a hard pitch for you? Like once we get to this double marathon every week to kind of really dive back, because now you're really going back to the show.
Well, it was, I have another career in real journalism. And so it was like turning a battleship around. I mean, I was like, you know, do I really want to like totally dive back 100% into this? But, you know, it was so much, people were so kind and people were so supportive. And they were, I mean, you wouldn't think that doing a silly little show like Monster Vision so many years ago, and I can't take credit for this, but people who were misfits as children,
yeah.
who didn't have a lot of friends, or maybe people who were even abused as children. Mm-hmm. They would say, you know, I would lock myself in my room and I would watch Monster Vision. And I would feel better. Mm-hmm. And you were my friend when I was 12 years old. I was like, oh man, it's like, I can't take credit for that. But, you know, it makes me feel good that it somehow, you know, it helped you in your life. Well, people were telling me all these stories, you know, one story after another after another. And so I always tell the crew, you know, I say, you know, we can't take credit for like making somebody's life better, but what we can do is stay late and get the show right, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, because that's what creates those experiences, you know. And so that's why we do that. That's why we have overtime, and that's why we come back and we fix something when it's wrong, and you know, because that's all you can do, you know. You just can make it as good as you can make it. But and then, you know, some 12-year-old kid comes up to you 20 years later and says, oh my God, I hated my life, but you know, I watched that show and it was so great, and you made me feel not guilty anymore about loving horror films because my mother hated them, and you know, she didn't want me watching them, and a lot of you know, some people in the industry, I won't name names, but a prominent guy in the industry says, you know, I was gay. I was embarrassed about it. I would go to the Times Square theaters and hang out, partly because there were other gay guys there, but also for the movies. And I associated my not coming out of the closet with the bad movies I was watching, and my parents reinforced that. And then your show came on, and I felt validated. Mm-hmm. I felt okay about myself.
Yeah,
you know. And it's like, wow, you know, it's like I, you know, horror has a big effect on people that other genres do not have. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. I mean, it's just amazing how deep people get into horror. And partly they get into it because it legitimizes things that they feel that they're not supposed to say in public. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, you know, for all these reasons, this is like a good space to be in. You know, so I'm going to do this for a while. I'm going to do this for a while because people appreciate it. You know, the horror audience is the best audience in the world. The ironic thing about people who love violent movies is that they're the least violent people in the world.
Right. Well, I agree completely.
We always talk about that, and you've talked about two of them. I mean, I think of Tobe Hooper and Wes Craven. I think of, like, just these very kind humans.
Yes.
You know, and then you see the movie, the images they create, and you go,
I always think Mick Garris. I'm like, he's vegetarian. Yeah. He is just the sweetest guy. I mean, it's...
His company's called Nice Guy Productions.
Yes. Yeah, Nice Guy Productions, yeah.
But I think it's also your passion. We can still see your passion to talk about these things. I mean, that's how we feel. Like, we couldn't keep doing our show if we didn't still love the movies, because people would see through it straight away. Part of this intimacy that you're creating with an audience is that you care. You provide really fun context to the movies. I think people who don't know your show would just think you're doing a TNA count, but when you actually watch it, it's like, you know, it's historical, a lot of it, and factual.
Well, people that love horror movies, they want to know about every single horror movie from the beginning of time. Yeah. They want to know Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and they also want to know, they want to be the first ones in to see Us.
Yeah.
You know, and then they want to know about every movie in between, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's a demanding audience too, you know. And it's much more demanding today than it was in the 90s because everybody has all this information. Mm-hmm. And so if you make one mistake, they are all over you. I'm sure you guys know this.
Oh, God.
Every week somebody pulls a boner. It's like, how does...
And I mean, we talk for 2 hours completely off the cuff most of the time. And so when it's like, excuse me, that movie came out in 85 and you said 86, I'm like, okay, fair enough.
Oh, yeah. And if you make a big mistake, oh, my God, that's 1,000 people that are on top of you, you know?
Can't erase it.
And so it's a self-correcting thing now. You know, it's like you immediately know if you've screwed up. So for all these reasons, I'm really enjoying getting back in touch with the hardcore horror people, and actually the people who weren't even born when Monster Vision was on are actually the most avid supporters yeah. of things like 80s horror, mm-hmm. you know, and they sort of glamorize 80s horror and they turn it into, you know, this golden age of horror. It's now considered the golden age of horror.
Yeah.
You know, right. I guess in the same way that the 1930s were once considered the golden age of horror, nobody ever really considered the 40s the golden age of anything. The 50s were the golden age of black and white sci-fi.
Yeah.
You know, the 60s were the golden age of what? Biker movies? I don't know.
Yeah,
it's the rise of the independence, maybe. But no, even that
yeah,
was
yeah, maybe a little bit. Sam 50s. Arkoff yeah. and guys like that, you know, and the 70s were just like anything goes, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
And then, but the 80s, they fasten on the 80s, maybe because just their age, you know, but,
it's also the imagination of those movies. They're a lot more, I feel like they're more big budgets and creative and more effects.
Yeah.
And
yeah, we always talk about how fantastical that era was. I don't know if it was just the Coke or yeah. what people were doing in the business yeah. at the time, but.
Well, I mean, a lot of people don't realize that Star Wars changed sci-fi from being a cheap disposable commodity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or maybe 2001 A Space Odyssey did that, yeah. but I don't think so, because it was British and it was special and it wasn't really perceived as changing the sci-fi genre. It was a special Stanley Kubrick thing, yeah. you know. But Star Wars, suddenly you couldn't make a cheap sci-fi movie anymore. Yeah. You had to have the special. I mean, Roger Corman continued yeah. to try. He made Forbidden World. He made some other stuff, you know, but basically the low budget sci-fi was over. And so low budget went in other directions, and it went in a lot of directions because it was the era of straight to video. Mm-hmm. And so guys like Jim Wynorski are out there, you know, here, I have $40,000. Let's make a movie.
Yeah.
And so suddenly you have all this stuff on the video shelves and you have people making movies that otherwise wouldn't have been made. And, now, why today, with the cheap technology, don't we have the same thing going on? I don't know. Yeah. It's like, because it's cheap to make a movie. I mean, you don't really need very much money. Where are the Jim Wynorskis? Where are the politically incorrect guys who are going against the culture and like shocking people? You know, we don't have so many of those. Even at a time when we have all these guys coming out of film school, they have the cheap technology, they have the cheap camera, they have the cheap post-production stuff. There's no reason that they're not gathering a little creative group and making truly horrifyingly politically incorrect rebel movies, you know, but they're not. They're making homages to the 80s.
Yep. Yeah, that's true.
That's wrong. Yeah.
I know we have to wrap up, so final question. I mean, obviously, a lot of the movies that you host on your show are things that you reviewed when they came out.
Yep.
But how much do you keep up on modern horror? I mean, coming to festivals like this, do you have time to see? Yeah.
No, I don't have time. I try to keep up with it, but I don't have time. I mean, we're showing, I don't know when this is going to air. Is this going to air?
We don't know yet.
Probably within the next week.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I assume it's going to air later than tomorrow night.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, a movie that we recently showed on the last drive-in tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night in the past.
Yeah. Is Deathgasm. Okay.
Oh. I like that movie so much.
Now, Deathgasm is a New Zealand movie that's sort of a ripoff of Trick or Treat from the 80s.
Yeah,
it's an homage to those movies in the 80s that proceeded from the premise of, what if Tipper Gore is right and rock music has demonic messages and it turns people into, you know, raving demons. Now, so, all right. Well, it's interesting that the movie would come out of New Zealand.
Yeah.
It's interesting that they sort of ape American styles. It's interesting that they would be doing this theme 20 years after that was any kind of issue, as though the culture in New Zealand was delayed two decades.
That's actually accurate. I'm from New Zealand.
Oh, you're from New Zealand.
Everything there is like 20 years after the trend.
Okay.
A little less now that the internet's there, but yeah.
Okay.
I think you guys are like just now getting hair bands.
No, but there is a little bit of that delay, you know.
Okay, so
I can confirm.
So, So that's a very interesting recent movie. In my opinion, it falls apart a little bit in the third act, yeah, and just becomes a series of special effects, and they're funny effects and they're impressive effects, but you know, they kind of give up some story value just to do the effects at the end. I do watch some. I mean, I love Ty West made a movie called House of the Devil. But again, he seems to be doing an homage to the 80s. Mm-hmm. It's one of the better homages, yeah, to the 80s, but you know, it's a very powerful film, and the star of it, I always wondered why
Jocelyn Donahue.
I wondered why Jocelyn Donahue is not a huge star. On that one performance.
She's in a lot of indie stuff, but you're right, she hasn't, and a lot of commercials. I'll turn on TV and I'll see her in a car commercial, yeah, and it's always, yeah, surprising.
But didn't really break out as a huge movie star, you know? I do watch more recent stuff, and of course, everyone keeps up with Jordan Peele, and I keep up with Jordan Peele, yeah, but the things that people want me to talk about are the classic movies, or the quote forgotten gems. Yeah. It's a forgotten gem, Joe Bob, and it's like, no, it's not. It's a crappy movie that didn't get distributed.
Yeah. Well, on that note, thank you for Howling 5.
That last week. Yeah.
No, Howling. Howling 7.
The musical. Seven. Yes,
you're talking about Howling 7.
Yeah. I left and bought the VHS as soon as we got off
air. It's only on VHS.
Only on VHS. And as soon as you said biker werewolf musical, I was like, there is a God. This movie has clearly been gifted to me and I must own this. And it was amazing.
Did it make you want to go to Pioneer Town?
It was definitely.
We need a group viewing of this. I haven't seen this one.
It's fun. And he wasn't kidding. It is a musical. It's got these weird little musical interludes in it that you're just like, okay.
It's got spectral line dancing for no reason in the middle of it. Yeah, it uses footage from The Howling 3, 4, 5, and 6.
A lot of flashbacks.
Well, let's hope one day you do the pig fucking movie for Shudder. I'm sure those insights will be brilliant.
You won't offend anyone, young or old, pig fucking.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
All right.
we'll let you catch a flight.
Well,
now.
We started with pig fucking. We're ending with pig fucking. What could be better than that?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Joe Bob, for doing this again.
Yeah. And thanks for supporting the Chattanooga Film Festival.
This is it, though. No, nobody can do more than two Shockwaves podcasts.
We're coming back to you next year.
In one lifetime.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Joe Bob.
Thanks, guys.
All right.
Tonight's Shockwaves is brought to you by the following advertisers. Tonight's episode is brought to you by Full Moon Entertainment. Get ready to delve deep into the weird world of essential cult entertainment only on Full Moon's Amazon channel. Classic Full Moon and Empire picture faves like Castle Freak, Puppet Master, Subspecies, Necropolis, Intruder, Head of the Family, Evil Bong, The Ginger Dead Man, Laser Blast, The Pit and the Pendulum, and Lurking Fear share space with a wild library of cult creepers from the legendary Blue Underground and Something Weird video labels, the Andy Sedaris and Jess Franco collections, the Euroscene archives, Trailers from Hell, and much, much more. It's an unlimited onslaught of awesome right at your fingertips 24/7. New uncut movies are added every week, and all titles are available in the highest definition available. So get yourself over to Amazon and subscribe to Full Moon today for only $6.99 a month. Your glaze balls will never be the same again. Trust us.
Available now from exploitation film gurus at Vinegar Syndrome, Juan Antonio Bardem's atmospheric Spanish giallo, The Corruption of Chris Miller, plus two from legendary producer Nico Mastorakis, Familial Terror at Grandmother's House, and Trashy Slasher Antics in Darkroom, plus Gerard Damiano's introspective sex drama, Skinflicks. Coming soon in May, the North American Blu-ray premiere of Mountaintop Motel Massacre, plus two surprise limited edition releases, including an early 80s regional horror gem, all of which and much, much more will be unveiled during their infamous Halfway to Black Friday sale occurring Memorial Day weekend at VinegarSyndrome.com. Also, don't forget to visit them at Texas Frightmare Weekend in Dallas, Crypticon in Seattle, and Pop-Up in at Videomatica in Vancouver. For more info on their upcoming Halfway to Black Friday sale, releases, and conventions, visit VinegarSyndrome.com.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Fangoria.
In July of 1979, the first issue of Fangoria was released into the world. And now, this summer, Fangoria magazine is turning 40 and celebrating accordingly with its fourth issue. 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated content honoring horror's past, present, and future. These articles and interviews will never be published online, so the only way to read them is by getting your hands on a physical, collectible copy of your own. We can't give anything away because we want the experience to be a surprise, but we can safely say that you do not want to miss a single page in issue 4. Head to Fangoria.com to learn more and subscribe. If you subscribe today, your subscription starts with the 40th anniversary issue, number 4, shipping in July. Use the code SHOCKWAVES to save 10% off your subscription. Again, that code is SHOCKWAVES for 10% off, so go ahead on over to Fangoria.com.
Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. We're celebrating halfway to Halloween with a classic retro-style nylon jacket on pre-order from now through Sunday, May 5th. And Barbara Crampton will be debuting her very own signature shirt at Texas Frightmare, which will also be available exclusively on our site Monday, May 6th. Brand new shirts, pins, and socks coming next Wednesday for Return of the Living Dead. And our Shockwaves listeners can save 10% now at checkout by entering code WAVES10. Again, that's 10% off by using code WAVES10.
The Shockwaves crew is currently at Texas Frightmare, presented by Arrow Video. This is the Southwest premier horror convention, now in its 14th year. So if you are listening to this, please head on over to Texas Frightmare, happening right now. We are there with Bruce Campbell, Tim Curry, Robert Englund, Lee Majors, Meatloaf, Joe Bob Briggs, and many more. Film celebrations include Halloween, Reanimator, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Rocky Horror Picture Show, and Evil Dead. This is May 3rd through 5th, 2019, at the Hyatt Regency DFW Airport. Shockwaves is there right now. Please head on over to www.texasfrightweekend.com for more information, and we hope to see you there.